Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Lori Wagner, a member of the club's LGBT forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listeners on the radio and we invite our audience to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Our program today is entitled Injustice Anywhere is a Threat to Justice Everywhere, Building Solidarity in the Intersections of Social Justice. The LGBT community owes a great debt to the African American Civil Rights Movement, and now it's my pleasure to introduce two of the luminaries of that movement, our distinguished speakers, Reverend Eric Lee and Reverend Deborah Johnson. Reverend Lee is president and CEO of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference of Greater Los Angeles. Reverend Lee has long been a civil rights activist and became a hero to many in the LGBT community for his early and sustained stand against Prop 8. Taking this position has put him at odds with his church, colleagues, and family, but not with his conscience. He advocates supporting all disenfranchised communities unequivocally. Reverend Deborah Johnson is the founding minister and president of Inner Light Ministries. She is an LGBT leader who served on the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force and is known for bringing clarity to complex and emotionally charged issues. She recently received the UC Santa Cruz Tony Hill Award for her work in building solidarity between communities and developing innovative approaches to solving social problems. She's done a great deal of work on Prop 8 issues. And without further ado, I would like to turn you over to Reverend Lee.
If I could stand up.
You want? Sure. That's fine.
Thank you.
Thank you. I asked to stand up because being a preacher, we need to get all of our body involved in the presentation. It's a privilege and pleasure to be here at the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco. I want to thank Lori Wagner for inviting me to be here, and I also want to thank our co-panelist and speaker, Reverend Deborah, for the fight that she has waged for equality in not just the LGBT community, but for all communities. And it's because of people like Lori and Reverend Deborah that we do have, I think, a clear path for the pursuit of justice and equality. I want to talk a little bit about the intersections of this pursuit for justice. When it was around, I think it was the Democratic National Convention in Colorado, when a simple question was asked of me. What did I believe about marriage equality? And it was a simple question, so I had a simple answer. The marriage equality is a justice issue. Little did I know at that time that my response and my position would envelop me in a controversy within my own organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, within the African American community, and particularly with the clergy, and within the LGBT community, because I did point out that there were some deficiencies in the relationship in our pursuit of justice. Let me begin with what the National Southern Christian Leadership Conference sought to do to me when I took a stand for marriage equality. They sent me a show cause letter, which essentially stated they asked me to report to Atlanta within 5 days to show cause why they should not censor or remove me because of my position on marriage equality. And I quickly wrote them back and asked them to show cause to me why I needed to show cause to them about this issue of justice. This is Dr. Martin Luther King's organization, The mantra for our organization is that injustice anywhere was a threat to justice everywhere. And as I saw the issue of marriage equality simply as a justice issue, because the state of California or states across the country issue a license for people to be married, that anytime you denied one group of people the same rights and privileges that marriage affords to all other people, then that is a violation of their civil rights. And so I was very clear in my understanding of this position of marriage equality. Well, needless to say, they couldn't censor me, because you can't censor the truth. And they couldn't remove me, because they didn't install me. We had our own separate 501c3, our own board that fully supported me. And the most they could do, which they still didn't do, was to not recognize us as a charter chapter of the national organization. Now, what happened is somehow the New York Times got word of this and ran an article on it. And then the LA Times ran an article. And people of good conscience then began sending letters and emails and texts and phone calls to the national office and say, how could you take this position? And quite frankly, they still haven't responded adequately enough to how they could take a position of neutrality now. They would not be bold enough to say that they were against marriage equality, but they took a position of neutrality. And I would challenge our traditional and historical civil rights organizations like the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, like the NAACP, to not be afraid to take a position on justice. And so we have work to do on this. The position that I took did cause some conflict within the African-American community in general, but more specifically within the clergy community. And I believe that it was because of the centuries of history and tradition and religion about what relationships are supposed to look like, or what we subscribe to in society, that people were afraid to look at relationships in any other way. And so there was some isolation that occurred. There was some rejection of speaking and preaching opportunities. And it still did not deter me from the fundamental right of any consenting, taxpaying adult to have the rights and privileges of marriage. In fact, I would engage in purposely in conversations with the African-American clergy to have them, not for me to defend myself, but have them defend themselves in denying rights to people. And so it was clear to me that this was a civil rights issue, and I stand on that today, and will continue to stand on that. Some of the challenges that, particularly the campaign on marriage equality that we faced, and that I saw, was that it was framed pretty much exclusively within a religious context. And it was driven largely by the Mormon Church and the very conservative wing of Christianity and the multiple faith or belief systems within our nation. And once the issue of relationships or marriage equality was framed within a religious context, it was very hard to get out of that. And so we had to meet. The dialogue had to take place within that context. And we have been arguing about religion since humanity has been on this planet. And so it was a very effective strategy for those who were against marriage equality. And And so that was one of the challenges that we faced. I think another challenge that we faced was that those who were largely responsible for leading the campaign for marriage equality, and I had some criticisms of this, tried to make it synonymous with the civil rights movement that African Americans participated in some 40 or 50 years ago. And though there are some similarities in that there was a fight for dignity and social justice and economic justice, the differences were more telling than the similarities. And for African Americans in particular, to make the movement for LGBT equality or marriage equality specifically synonymous with the Black civil rights movement was an affront to African Americans. And let me tell you how. The discrimination that took place against African Americans was based on race, was based on ethnicity, the hue of one's skin color, the texture of the hair, the shape of the lips or the nose, something that was a biological marker that could not be avoided. You could not hide or disguise. And then that discrimination was couched within an economic context in which African Americans were denied the opportunity for equal access to housing, to education, and employment. And you couple with that people not having a dialogue yet or understanding or believing that being gay or lesbian, being LGBT, was a matter of birth rather than a matter of choice. Which it doesn't matter to me. However, these were some of the complex issues that African Americans in the analysis of whether or not this was a civil right caused many to say that you cannot make the movement for marriage equality synonymous with the civil rights movement that African Americans suffer because of those reasons. The concept of being in the closet means that the LGBT community could adjust behavior, hide behavior, to avoid the persecution that African Americans could not avoid. And I think at the bottom of that distinction between the Black civil rights movement and the movement for LGBT equality and marriage equality is that key point. Now, how do you deal with it? And see, I think that if you want to make it synonymous, I think the way to do that is if every LGBT person came out of the closet and said, just like we used to say, I'm Black and I'm proud, to say I'm gay and I'm proud. But to ask someone to willingly submit themselves to some persecution is a difficult ask. But what I think would happen is that if the LGBT community collectively came out and said, you know, this is who I am, and they did suffer persecution, as African Americans did, and it was publicized, as it was in the march to Selma over the Edmund Pettus Bridge when the police beat mercilessly innocent, peaceful protesters for justice, and which was televised around the world. That's where the movement for social and economic justice and racial justice for African Americans turned in this country, when the persecution was televised and America was embarrassed for its bigotry. Well, America needs to be embarrassed again for its bigotry. Because I will tell you that African Americans do not object to equality when it comes to the benefits and privileges of marriage. If you were to ask every one of them, would you object to a gay or lesbian couple having the same rights and privileges that you have in marriage as a heterosexual couple? I guarantee you they said, no, we wouldn't object to it. Where the challenge is in calling it marriage. And that's because of the religious, historical, traditional, and cultural beliefs about what marriage is supposed to be. But that's only because we haven't had the dialogue about sexuality. And that dialogue needs to take place in the church. And so, you know, I resist the attempts to put the burden of the defeat of marriage equality upon African Americans, because we don't make up that much of the population. And here in California, it's about 9% of the population. So one, we could 100% could have voted for marriage equality and still probably would not have passed. The work is not just in the African-American community. However, you will find a very strong ally in the African-American community because of our history of fighting for justice and civil rights and equality. But that relationship as an ally cannot be based on an episodic relationship where it's asking for help for justice and no further relationship exists beyond that. Because what had occurred was the coming to African-American leaders and say, can you support us in this quest for justice? And then we saw we had no previous relationship and we had no relationship after that. So what has to happen is there needs to be the building of a relationship with not just the African-American community, but the immigrant community. Because one of the other challenges that I see in our quest for justice is that we are operating in the silos of civil rights, where we're fighting for the civil rights of LGBT people, and that's it. Or the civil rights of the immigrant community, and that's it. Or the civil rights of the African-American community, and that's it. And as long as we do that, then we never have the converging points of justice where we work together fighting for human rights, and we stay isolated in our fight for civil rights, which is particular and pertinent to just one person, one group of people. And so we have to move to a point where Dr. King said injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, that we take that at its fundamental and core premise, that if you see an injustice occurring against anybody, whether it's directly impacting you or not, that you cannot remain silent about that injustice anymore. The opportunity to make marriage equality a reality is before us. But I think that the work has to be done internally first in the LGBT community, where there's a development of a strategy that says we're going to build relationships with people, not for the purpose of winning equality, but for the purpose of having the dignity of each person's humanity affirmed. You know, to this day, there are far too many people that still do not, heterosexual people that do not have a relationship with someone who is LGBT to this day. And there are far too many LGBT people that refuse to engage in relationships with people who are heterosexual. And that isolation will destroy any move towards a universal justice. And so we need to move from the silos of civil rights to the pursuit of human rights, where it doesn't matter what color, what the issue is, what the gender is, what the gender preference is. We need to move together, because unless we do, then the forces that continue to keep people bound and oppressed will always be able to do that, because they do that by separating people based on their specific issues. And so it's important, it's critically important for us as a people, as a humanity, to commit ourselves to fighting against an injustice. It was the German pastor who stated, they came for the socialists, and because I wasn't a socialist, I didn't speak up. And they came for the Jew, and because I wasn't a Jew, I didn't speak up. And they came for the communists, and because I wasn't a communist, I didn't speak up. When they came for me, there was no one left to speak for me. We cannot let these words just be words that fall upon deaf ears, just like we can't let the words of Dr. King that said injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere fall upon deaf ears. We have allowed the messages of our martyred heroes to stay in this dream state. I tell you, what really concerns me is that we put so much emphasis on the I have a dream speech of Dr. King, you know, that we stay in this dream state and never move to the reality of what justice is supposed to be. Have you ever been in one of those dreams that you just can't get out of, or you wake yourself up and when you go back to sleep, you're in that same dream and you've done everything you can to get out of it and you just can't get out of it? Well, that seems to be where we are in our society. It is time for another social revolution to take place, where we stop looking at one another through the prisms of gender or ethnicity or culture and just start looking at the humanity of one another. It's time for another social revolution to take place. But the only way that's going to happen, and right now, the only movements that I see taking place is the LGBT movement and the immigration reform movement. And I say, let's leverage that opportunity to bridge the gaps between cultures and ethnicities and genders and become one people that move towards the universal concept of human rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Reverend Lee. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Injustice Anywhere is a Threat to Justice Everywhere. And now I'd like to introduce, or have come forward, if you'd like, you can either sit or come up, Reverend Lee, Reverend Johnson.
Good evening, and thank you for your comments, Reverend Lee. I'm on your page.
Okay.
I really am. So much so that we've actually started a forum called Prop 8, What's at Stake, looking at the larger issues and using it as an opportunity. We had an event not too long ago called Together We Stand, where we were looking at LGBT equality, reproductive choice, immigration rights, immigration reform, civil rights, all at one time. As a matter of fact, we have some CDs from that back there, so we look forward to continuing to work with you on the intersection of those issues. I have many comments that I would like to make, and I will keep them within my time frame and would love to engage in a dialogue about all of it. I'm going to take this a slightly different direction. One, as an African American, and one who has been a veteran in the LGBT movement for many, many years. I mean, like, many years. Like 39 years I've been actively in this movement, first starting at the L.A. Gay and Lesbian Community Services Center, where I served on the board of directors at 823 and was there at the center when it first got started. And I've worked with many, many groups in many different environments. And I honestly believe that it takes someone like me who's at the cross-section of being both gay and African-American to say some of the things that I think, quite honestly, need to be said. One of the things that I would like to do, first off, is to set history straight a little bit. There was a move that came out in the mid-'80s to draw a wedge between the African-American community as gatekeepers of the civil rights movement and the LGBT community. And I'm sad to say that it's been a brilliant job, it's been a brilliant tactic, and we've all been bamboozled. And we need to remember the history. There is not a single victory that the LGBT community has ever had, on the legal front especially, that was not somehow rooted in a precedent that was set prior to that that had something to do with racial justice, racial equality, or from the women's movement in the right to privacy. It's been an add-on. I'm sure of this. I'm so sure of it that I personally won the first case in the state of California in 1984, where the courts ruled that sexual orientation was meant to be included in our unruh Civil Rights Act. The very first case where sexual orientation even began to be considered as a civil rights issue. If you look at employment, it'll be the same thing. If there's non-discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity, it is an expansion of already existing programming. Don't ask, don't tell, marriage equality, all of these, if you look at the rulings of the courts, they are all based upon the rulings that happened years ago around racial issues. I can't say this enough. It is as though there is a bank account that we keep as an LGBT community making withdrawals out of and thinking that we don't have a responsibility to also make a deposit in it. There is an infrastructure, which Reverend Lee is speaking about justice, about fairness, about equality. And you have to be involved in maintaining the very infrastructure of all of that. Not just making sure that your little issue du jour playing identity politics is what's going to be at the top of the heat in the 11 o'clock news. Contrary to popular belief, African Americans have played a key role in the development of LGBT equality. If you go all the way back to Stonewall, in 1969. Those were black and brown trans people. Those were black and brown drag queens. And I want you to really catch the significance of this. I doubt seriously if white people would have rioted. But in 1969, the cities were already in flame. Black people were already rioting about police brutality. It was just one more riot. It was just one more thing. We were already in that mindset. We were already there, ignited the movement. The whole pride movement, black and brown people. One of the first big markers that led us to LGBT equality was the sodomy laws being repealed. State of California, who introduced the sodomy repeal law? Willie Brown, a black man, in the assembly. It got stuck to a tie vote 6 years later in 1975. And then Senate Majority Leader George Moscone locked the chambers and waited for Lieutenant Governor Mervyn Dimely to be flown in from Denver to cast.
Right.
To cast the tie-breaking vote. that allowed the sodomy law to come down. The whole rainbow, that's a symbol of the LGBT community. It's sort of ironic to me because prior to Jesse Jackson running for the Democratic presidency, we had never been recognized by any national party. We had been known of as Lavender. Lavender everything. Jesse Jackson put the LGBT community in the Rainbow Coalition. Said that your color, lavender, is not out there on its own. It's part of a broader rainbow. And we as the LGBT community have just run and taken over the whole rainbow. And there are no other colors in that. That was the exact same time when I was winning my particular lawsuit. The Black Congressional Caucus has always stood with us. When we couldn't get any headway whatsoever with the federal government on AIDS, it was the Black mayors who came forth. It was Tom Bradley in Los Angeles. It was Dinkins in New York, who were the first ones to set up what we call the AIDS czars back in the day. I can go on and on and on, but I really want you to feel what I'm saying. We have this tendency to think of the African-American community in a very monolithic way. There is no monolithic African-American community. And the church does not exclusively represent the African-American community. Because truth be told, most of the church was not for the civil rights movement during the time of Dr. Martin Luther King. Well, can the truth be said, church? Why was there even a Southern Christian Leadership Conference that had to be started in the first place? The civil rights leaders, I want to make that very clear. Phil Lawson, all these are reverends. Reverend James Lawson, Reverend James Lawry, Reverend Andrew Young, Reverend Jesse Jackson, Reverend Chip Murray. I mean, the list just goes on. And they have been there for us. They have stood there for us. And they have been the ones to frame in the first place that we are part of a broader civil rights movement. When you look at the Black community, the Black, for lack of a better word, intelligentsia, the Oprah Winfreys, the Maya Angelous, the Michael Eric Dysons and the Cornel West and the Spike Lee and on and on and on. They are so visibly out there and pro-gay. So we have a dilemma here. When you have folks like Reverend Lee and all these folks that I could just continue to name over and over and over who are sticking their necks out, Obama mentioned gay people in his acceptance speech at the Democratic Party. Maya Angelou 20 years ago mentioned gay people in on the Pulse of Mourning for Clinton's inauguration. I'm talking about folks that are putting themselves out there on the line. The NAACP marched with us in Stonewall 25. I was there. If we want to continue to be successful, we have to learn as an LGBT community what reciprocity means. And it's not just with the African American community. Planned Parenthood is hanging on by a thread now. The House has already defunded all of their federal funding. The women's movement has always stood with the LGBT movement. But where have we been for the women's movement? Where is our outcry now to make sure that that voice is there? We have to do better. I think part of it is a way that we have to reframe things. I facilitate a lot of the quote-unquote think tanks where the I want to call them mucky mucks, but that's not appropriate because they're my esteemed colleagues in all different, the heads of the organizations, the big civil rights organizations, the scholars, the what I'm saying is it the people who are in a position to be able to affect change, and I have an opportunity to be around a lot of those tables. And we have a tendency sometimes to want to only, quote unquote, fund or do something if it's a, quote unquote, gay issue. Within the LGBT community, it's got to be, quote unquote, a gay issue. Now, mind you, we are a microcosm of the whole entire society. So in that vein, if anything happens to anybody, it's going to be an LGBT issue by default, just numerically speaking. I contend that there is no such thing as a gay issue. Hang with me. There is no such thing as a gay issue. There are issues. There's immigration, there's education, there's housing, there's marriage, there's employment, there's job discrimination. There are issues. And then there's how those issues impact different groups and different organizations. I'm going to sit down in 2 minutes. And I want to give you a couple of concrete examples of why it is so important that we see things through these lenses if, in fact, we're going to get out of our silos, recognizing that injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. We must think differently. So we're all excited now about this repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That could have come down years ago if we had really dealt with the issue for what it was about. The LGBT community has a tendency to always want to frame things from the standpoint of freedom too. And this is very problematic, particularly the African American community and other oppressed communities that are always thinking of freedom as freedom from. Freedom to versus freedom from. And the LGBT community rarely articulates what it's going to be free from. So we have pushed the whole military issue as the freedom, quote unquote, to serve. When you look at it statistically, regardless of all of the hullabaloo about we have to have combat readiness and blah, 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 the majority of people discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell are women. More women than men, and disproportionately black and brown. We have a gender, race, and a class issue. These are women who are going to the military to get out of the ghetto, to get out of the barrio. They are not going to get athletic scholarships. They want jobs. They want retirement plans. They want health insurance. They want to get a house. Think of the implications of this. Can you imagine how different it would be if the LGBT community went out and talked about Don't Ask, Don't Tell as employment discrimination, which is what it is at the bottom line, the biggest employer, the federal government. But no, we're talking about simply the freedom to serve. And I'm telling you, conversation I had decades ago, an NAACP said we would be willing to march with you on that at any time because it's impacting us. And it's impacting our community. I could go on and on. But the bottom line here is that every single quote unquote issue has with it ways in which it impacts people based upon their age, their race, their gender, their class. And if we are willing to look at the big issue and pay attention to how people are impacted, we will find that there are all kind of ways to collaborate, to build synergies, to have those longer lasting relationships that Dr. Lee is talking about, because we can see that there's a way that we are all in stake at this. My final point, in all of the marriage equality stuff, To me, the point that we are missing is that what happened with Proposition 8 should never happen again. And to let Proposition 8 stand is a threat to any minority of any position. To allow the majority to take away the constitutional rights of the minority should scare everybody half to death. And once again, if we quit talking about it as simply the freedom to marry and talking about it more as the freedom from the tyranny of majority rule, overlooking minority rights, we'd get a little bit further. We would. So I'm going to end my comments now so we can exchange, and thank you.
So compelling. I haven't gotten any questions from the audience, so I think rather than doing this written, we'll go with the flow here. And if anybody has a question, raise their hands and just do it. I think we have enough. We're a small enough group that we can hear. So, okay.
I appreciate the background that you gave on the history of Stonewall. I'm old enough to remember that San Francisco was doing the very same thing in the 60s before Stonewall, and it indeed was the black and brown drag queens who put their lives on the line here on the West Coast as well.
Would you mind saying it in the microphone? Because this is being recorded for radio, I want to make sure that these comments... Why don't we take one of these? Not to be... taking over here. You better watch me.
I just appreciated your background of Stonewall, but I'm old enough to remember that in San Francisco, it was the drag queens, the black drag queens and the brown drag queens who were putting their necks on the line here. But history points out Stonewall and neglects the fact that the same thing was happening here. To me, we need to acknowledge that part of our history here in the West Coast, and we particularly need to acknowledge that it was black and brown people who put their lives on the line, and they were arrested and thrown in jail here in San Francisco as well as in New York.
Yes. We're riding on their courage. That's not a bad thing. It could continue to be an inspiring thing.
Thank you, both of you, for a very inciting and insightful delivery. And I just wanted to say, Dr. Lee, you mentioned that, or Reverend Lee, you mentioned two movements here that you felt were really inspirational and seemed to be having a lot of momentum, that being the LGBT movement and immigration movement. But I feel like, again, one of the things about the LGBT movement here in the States is that we tend to be very insular in terms of not even looking beyond the U.S. borders. There are many exciting things that are happening internationally that are issue-based, that have a very integral participation of queer people. If you look to South Africa, for example, what's happening in South Africa, if you look to what's happening even in India, the Global South is like on fire with a lot of things that I think here we in the United States could learn from, because they have not created these silos, because for one thing, they deal with the class issue. And they deal with women's issues as integral human rights, and they're sort of cross-cutting things. So that's one thing. And the second thing is, I feel like even here in this country, there's a lot happening around in terms of youth, and how even with this generation of young people that's coming up now, and how it looks very different from those of us who were coming out and coming of age, say in the 70s and 80s, and the kinds of things that we can learn from young people that have a more integrationist approach and have kind of kicked off the silos. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you.
And yet internationally, we still have tremendous persecution. I was with a young brother from Kenya, Uganda last night, who had to flee for his life because he was gay, and so you know, the reality is that you know, as a nation, not only as a nation, but internationally, we still have a long way to go to begin looking at people simply as a human being and affirming them and the dignity of their humanity. And we haven't gotten there as a human race yet. I will say that in terms of the young people, a lot of this is generational. I made this comment last night because young people will say, what's the big deal? And so I think that in every movement, I think every movement is fueled by the young people, the young generation. And we see a movement amongst them now, but they don't have the guidance or the infrastructure to make the strides that we made some 40 or 50 years ago. And you also have to understand that the civil rights movement that was engaged in by the African-American community, well, it wasn't the only African-American community. It was every community. There is no way with black folks making up 12% of the population that if it were less to us alone that we'd eliminate Jim Crow segregation, legal discrimination, and have the laws on the books change. So it took the majority of society to recognize and commit to making the change. And so we still have a long way to go on that. And I think also the movement for equality back in the 50s and 60s had been going on for over a couple hundred years. And so we can't look at any social economic movement in a snapshot of time like we do the civil rights movement, say it happened in 64 and 65, and think that that's, you know, that you know, all the work was done within that 10 or 20 year period. We were fighting this since the Emancipation Proclamation. And so, and I'm not saying it's going to take that long for marriage equality to take place, but we must put it in its proper context when understanding how movements grow and develop. And there is one more movement, but we don't have the right people involved with it, and that's education reform movement. Okay, and it's interesting to me that the people who seem to be running the education reform movement are the wealthy white folks, based on the academic, I'm trying to remember my audience, but based on the horrible failing statistics of black and brown children. And so where are, as conscious liberals when it comes to education reform, and why are we not leading that charge for our children? Because it's within that context in educating our children that we start minimizing these issues of discrimination and oppression. It comes with education. And we are not doing a good job in educating our children. I mean, look at how hard it is in the schools to deal with sexuality and gender preference.
Yes.
Okay. I'm done on that one.
There's a comment that I would like to make about this that has to do with privilege. Well, I'm a preacher. And, forgive me for going here, but to whom much is given, much is required. And if we're going to do this dance at the intersections, then the LGBT community must be able to articulate its struggles within a broader context so that it doesn't appear as though everything is just about me, more entitlement, more rights, more freedom, more whatever. That you must be able to articulate why your moving ahead is not only going to benefit society as a whole, but how is your moving ahead going to create the space for somebody else to move ahead. The civil rights movement was not just a black movement. Dr. King was very, very emphatic about that. And he used to tell the poor white people, you need to be marching with us. Because you are as oppressed as we are, which is part of the reason why he had to start speaking out against Vietnam. To see what's happening with the people in Vietnam. That the only way you're going to get allies to be able to operate at the intersections of inclusion is to be able to locate what you're doing in a larger struggle. So I'd like to reiterate again this battle that we're in now for Prop 8. Because we have an opportunity as an LGBT community to redeem ourselves if we move beyond this being simply about a marriage issue, but a social justice issue. Yes. Yes. That the rights of minorities are threatened when we allow the majority yes. Yes. to vote it away. This is huge. This is big. And if we can sound the alarm and take a leadership in this, we have an opportunity to really reposition ourselves in an alliance building way that Reverend Lee was talking about, where we will have some leverage for years to come on other quote unquote issues that are impacting LGBT people and other folk.
Let me just add the other danger that we faced is that the proposition process in itself is flawed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because anytime someone can, with enough money,
amen,
get something on the ballot because they don't like something about somebody, mm-hmm. My particular concern was really for black folks in this proposition process.
I'm with you. I'm with you, brother.
Who, you know, in our conspiracy theorist way, we still believe that, and you know, this may be true, that we're the only folks that have been written into the Constitution as amendments and having the right to vote when everybody else was given that, because it had to be renewed, or portions of it had to be renewed some 3 or 4 years ago. But the proposition process in itself is dangerous. Mm-hmm. Because we give anybody the right to put their personal agenda on a ballot, and you can get, with enough money and enough public relations, media savvy people, to convince people that it's right. Mm-hmm. And the majority is not always right. Mm-hmm. They've never been right. And so it is absolutely critical that In moving forward in the campaign, that it's not framed within the context of marriage equality, but simply justice.
Amen.
But it will be healthy for us as a nation to do that, as a state and as a nation, because then we can start looking at things universally and say, well, wait a minute. How are we failing 60% of African-American and Latino boys? They're dropping out of school and no one is saying anything about it. Because then they're pipelined into prison, and when they come out, there is no opportunity for them to get a livable wage job and take care of a family. And then couple that with them hooking up with an African-American woman, and the highest rate of HIV cases is amongst heterosexual black women, because these black men are coming out and not saying anything. There is a domino effect when we don't speak out against any injustice. It's going to impact us in so many different areas if we don't get a handle on this.
Okay, any more questions?
Mm-hmm. Or we can just keep preaching.
Just a slight addendum on this, not only the proposition process, but where we are now in the repeal in the Ninth Circuit, where... Yes, in the Ninth Circuit and in the California legislature, where now the groups are fighting to be able to represent their laws in court, not just to have the proposition, but even if it's deemed unconstitutional, to still be able to continue the battle to have it enacted.
Dr. Lee and Reverend Johnson, thank you so much for your strategic advice on building coalitions. So I want to get tactical for a minute. Dr. Lee, in your presentation, you said that the word marriage is a holdup or is an impediment towards building coalitions. Tactically, what would you suggest that the LGBT community or the opponents of Proposition 8 use instead of the word marriage, if anything?
Well, I hope I didn't suggest it was an impediment. What I said was that African Americans struggle with the term being used. They don't struggle with the concept of having the same privileges, rights and privileges marriage afford to everyone, but using the term is a sticking point. And we can use impediment. I'm not saying we don't use that term. What I'm saying is that we have to engage in a lot more conversation about what the term means before you just box it up and hand it to someone and say, here, this is what we want. There was very little discussion taking place with quote unquote allies in this pursuit of justice. It was basically a strategy that was constructed by a minority within the LGBT community. It was basically by white men, because there was the exclusion of a large part of the lesbian community and the LGBT community of color in identifying a strategy. Case in point, one of the leading LGBT organizations in Los Angeles called a meeting and to discuss how to reach out to the African American community, and I wasn't invited to the meeting. And I'm the only one down there doing this. And so when I found out about the meeting, you know, I made a couple calls and rattled the cages. I showed up anyway. And I looked at who was in the room. It was white men. They hired a firm, a consulting firm out of San Francisco that was white men. And I said, well, how are you going to do an analysis on what the black community is, how they're going to respond to marriage equality when you're not even black? So how are you going to do that? Now, they did have some black folks in there, but they were part of the LGBT community. And so what's occurring is either it's white men, white LGBT men, or LGBT exclusive. And there's no relationship building when you want to reach out to communities that you need support from in order to win marriage equality. And we got to stop framing it as narrow as marriage equality. But there's no discussion going on, and that's the problem. Because it's not just as simple as putting the term out there and say, we want this and you should vote for it because it's a justice issue. And that's basically the way it was presented. So, I don't have an answer for you. That's a preacher's way of saying I don't know.
Well,
we need to wind up now. I have a feeling we're going to.
She went through this last night, and, you know, I don't wind up real easy. I mean, wind down real easy. But I don't know. I think that that one of the things that we can do is I don't know, Reverend Deborah. I don't know.
My we need to wind up the program now. We continue the questions afterwards. Okay, that's where we're headed here. So our thanks to Reverend Lee, President and CEO of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference of Greater Los Angeles, and Reverend Johnson, Founding Minister and President, Inner Light Ministries, for their comments here today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as our radio audience, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is completed.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Let me answer that question. Two things. One, the issue of marriage is a red herring. And the conservatives know that. And we, as an LGBT community, have taking the bait, and we're barking up trees that we do not understand. The whole concept of marriage in the African American community is very different than how it plays out anyplace else. That the latest stats that I saw in Time magazine, 70% of African American babies are born out of wedlock. Black folk ain't getting married. Heterosexuals aren't getting married. But I mean, this is really serious to take. But there's such socio-political reasons back behind the destruction of the black family and all of that's about. So there are a lot of very sensitive issues about that. And you know the most common thing that I hear from African-American sisters, and I really want you to hear me on this. I can't get a brother to marry me. So why in the hell am I going to let a brother marry a white man? I got enough problem with the white women. But I really want you to catch that. It's not all this moral stuff and whatnot out there. There's just some real hardcore realities. There's a sibling rivalry in some respects that's happening with the black community and the gay community about privilege and entitlement and, you know, who's riding up and who's getting their thumb down. And we don't, unless we understand that, we can't go into that territory. The second thing that I want to say is that the African-American community has, or the LGBT community has done a very, very, very poor job of explaining why it is that there continue to be the legal extensions to the LGBT community based upon, quote unquote, past civil rights verdicts. Here's where it lies. And it isn't that complicated, but nobody ever gets the point. There are no laws restricting gay people from getting married. Gay people can get married. They can marry straight people. Gay men and lesbians have been marrying each other for years. There are no laws restricting gay people from getting married. The restriction is based on sex. No two men and no two women. And that's where the civil rights issue comes. That my being a woman, my being female, was no more of a choice than mine than being black. And if you're going to deny a marriage license to my partner and me because we're both female, that's no different than denying the marriage license to me because one of us is white and one of us is black. That's the fundamental issue, and it's so simple, and we don't say it. All the discrimination is based on sex. It's based on gender, that we are punished. We are beaten, humiliated, discriminated against for being non-gender conforming. Not because of what we do in our bedrooms, not even because we're in any kind of relationship, but because we haven't stayed in our place. There's a place that a male is supposed to be in and a place that a woman is supposed to be in, and it is no different than the place I was supposed to be in because I was black. You cannot limit people's choices about employment, housing, partnering, whatever, because of their sex. It is so basic. And I have found that whenever I just really talk to black people and break it down, there's this kind of, duh, should have had a V8 moment. It's like they get it. But we haven't communicated that. We haven't articulated that. And I'll just end on it. There's this sleight of hand. In my court case that I referenced before, back in 1984, what the court said was that clearly it was a restaurant discrimination suit, where we had gone to a restaurant literally to celebrate Martin Luther King's birthday. The year before was a holiday. Okay? I was with a Latina at the time, a Chicana. And what the court said was that clearly We had been discriminated against because of our sex. That had been the reason we were not served. However, if it had anything to do with the fact that we were a lesbian couple, they didn't know if we had any rights anymore. And it's this sleight of hand where what was once a right becomes a privilege. If it's about gay, that you had the right based upon your sex, whatever, but if it was gay, suddenly that became a privilege. That became a privilege. And we need to be able to discuss this stuff as discrimination based on sex. That's what it is. They don't care if they don't ask your sexual orientation. No two men and no two women. Period. End of report. And it's not even about gay. Bisexuals, trans people, they transition, they want to stay married to their partner, but they can't. It's broader even than just gay. When we look at all the implications of it all. Two bisexuals, both women marrying each other, does not make them gay.
Then maybe a strategy should be that our straight allies should go and get married. I mean, slightly
tongue-in-cheek. We just, if we're going to stand on the shoulders of certain laws, we have to understand them so that we are positioning ourselves within it. And I'll close with this, that we must make a deposit in the justice bank. You can't just keep making a withdrawal. We must make a deposit in the bank. The promissory note that King talked about in the famous I Have a Dream speech, so that somebody else can make a withdrawal on our deposit. Until that happens, we're just hanging out here, not doing our job.
Important issue because it was about protection of property.
No,
we ain't got no property.
I just really, really wanted to thank both of the panelists for coming in for speaking, and I feel that the timing is ideal because Proposition 8 was a nightmare from beginning to end, from every angle you can look at it. And it's been 2 years since then, almost three. And with anything, I was telling Brendan last night, eventually with time and water and sunshine, garbage turns to compost. And I think we finally have some compost. We have some opportunities for new seeds to be planted. There's a transition in leadership going on and in ways where I feel that we have new opportunities to come at this, even though we've all been doing this for many years, it with fresh new ways of presenting and framing and leaders and all of that. So I just feel that your recommendations and guidance and whatnot is just so important. And I hope that this radio program goes out on the web in a podcast and then everyone is required listening.
Prop 8 losing is one of the best things that it could have happened from a legal standpoint. That case that I talked about, that we lost. We lost the first couple of rounds. We finally won a unanimous opinion at the appellate court, and they certified it for publication. And then the Supreme Court refused to hear the case. So if we had won, we would have gotten a meal. But because we lost and went through the whole process, the whole laws were changed for everybody. It's very similar. If Prop 8 had not passed, there would just be marriage in California, and that would just, like, be it. But we have this incredible opportunity now with the way that it happened. I I hate to sound like a broken record here, but this has not been the case in any other part of the country where our Supreme Court in California already deemed, and I want you to catch that, that we already had the right to marry, that it was already in the Constitution. So to gut that out, it speaks to the heart of this whole proposition process that Reverend Lee was talking about, and how there's this idea that just because the majority wants it, it would be okay. But you can't put the rights of a minority up for the majority. If there had been a vote about Emancipation Proclamation, baby, I would still be picking cotton. There's certain things that are not negotiable. And here's where the religious groups, my church signed on the amicus brief that the religious groups had about Proposition 8, because the courts have also likened the freedom to choose your own partner with the freedom to choose your own religion. That it's a fundamental human right. Okay? And that it doesn't matter if you're the only one, and it doesn't matter if all the Christians in the world think you're going to hell for being a Buddhist. You still have a right to be the Buddhist. That it is not, that the majority of Christians does not have the right to take away your right to be a Buddhist. It's the exact same thing. And if we can articulate about the religious freedom, about the inclusion, about the Constitution, about all of the different things that are really at stake here, oh my God.
Equal protection under the law.
Equal protection under the law. And now that the Ninth Circuit has deemed Proposition 8 to be unconstitutional based upon the U.S. Constitution, 14th Amendment, enacted after slavery? Oh my God, the responsibility that is now on the backs of the LGBT community to really understand this ain't about you. This ain't about being free to be gay. That what is at stake here is so huge. For us to get a win based on the U.S. 14th Amendment, oh my God, we don't, It's like the LGBT community doesn't even understand. Fighting for rights, they don't even understand the significance of when they get them. But we have an opportunity here. We just need to do the thing. Amen.
Yeah. And I'd like to say, you know, I think this is terrific. I'm not sure that it'll go out on the radio, but there will be transcripts. And if anybody wants them, you know, contact me and we'll work that out, because I think some really important things were said here tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to give you one more card.
Okay. I know.